20. The Second Disinformation Operation, The Evolution of the Soviet Regime, Part 2. The Dissident Movement. Western hopes and expectations of liberalization in the Soviet Union, aroused by the disinformation of the early 1960s, were largely dashed by Soviet intervention in Czechoslovakia in 1968, which underlined the return to a form of neo-Stalinism in the Soviet Union associated with the leadership of Brezhnev. But this new brand of Stalinism seemed unable either to conceal or control the forces of internal opposition. The West witnessed the emergence not just of individual dissidents, but of an entire dissident movement. With an unofficial leader in the person of academician Andrei Sakharov, and with a marked capacity to survive persecution by the regime and maintain communication with the West, the phenomenon can be understood only in the light of past history and the new methodology. Genuine opposition to the communist system in the Soviet Union in the period 1958-60, when the new long-range policy and the KGB's new political role were being worked out, was deep-seated and intense. Dissatisfaction was widespread among workers, collective farmers, priests, and intellectuals. It was particularly strong among Ukrainian, Latvian, Lithuanian, and Jewish nationalists. The opposition rejected the Soviet regime in principle. Its members did not believe in the possibility of evolution. They firmly believed that freedom could come only through a new revolution, the overthrow of the regime, and the dissolution of the Communist Party. They did not call themselves dissidents, nor were they described as such by the regime. They were known in KGB and party documents as enemies of the people. The KGB was capable of preventing and neutralizing contacts between the West and genuine opponents of the regime. Publication of material regarded as inimical to Soviet interests was effectively suppressed. Two examples, known to the author in 1961, illustrate the point. In that you're a prominent Soviet author and journalist, V. Grossman, wrote an anti-Soviet book and tried to have it published abroad. The idea conveyed by the book was that the main fault in the Soviet leadership was not the cult of Stalin, but the cult of Lenin and his works. Grossman handed his manuscript to the former Swedish ambassador and dean of the Moscow Diplomatic Corps, Sulman. The KGB learned of this, and a special operational group was set up on Shelepin's instructions to use any available means to recover the manuscript. The Politburo was concerned at the effect it might have on foreign communist parties if it was published abroad, especially at a time when the new long-range policy had recently been adopted. Within days, the manuscript was delivered by Shelepin to the Politburo. The West knew nothing of the affair at the time. In the same year, a prominent scientist named Zagermister, a former Soviet deputy minister of geology who had access to important secret information on the status of nuclear questions in the Soviet Union, requested political asylum from the Israeli embassy in Helsinki while on a visit to Finland. His request was refused, and he was referred to the Finnish police. Through their secret sources in Finland, the KGB residency in Helsinki received a report that a prominent Soviet official had tried to defect to the West and had asked the Finnish authorities for help. The KGB intervened. Zagermister was handed over to the Soviet consul, Sergeyev, a KGB officer, who returned him to the Soviet Union in an embassy car. Zagermister was interrogated by the KGB in Moscow. He died of a heart attack when he was shown a copy of his conversation with the Finnish police. Again, nothing was known or published about this tragic incident in the Western press. The serious challenge to the regime from the real opposition required special measures. The preparations made by the Central Committee and the KGB to deal with this and other problems have been described. They were based on the techniques of political provocation and prophylaxis used with success by Dzerzhinsky in the 1920s. Briefly, Dzerzhinsky's GPU, faced with the problem of a strong internal opposition supported and exploited by émigrés and Western governments, created a false opposition movement known as the Trust, which it used to expose, confuse, and neutralize genuine internal and external opposition. By tricking the émigrés and Western intelligence services into supporting the Trust, they effectively isolated the genuine internal opposition from the outside world. Furthermore, the successful projection through the Trust of a false image of the Soviet regime in evolution toward a more conventional national European system helped the Soviet leaders to achieve their diplomatic aims, such as recognition by and closer relations with the major European powers and China, the acquisition of Western economic expertise, and, through the Treaty of Rapallo, the supply of military aid by Germany. Applying the new methodology to the emergence of the present dissident movement means taking into account, all the evidence of a return to Dzerzhinsky's techniques of political provocation and disinformation. Following the weakness and evolution pattern and, in particular, the known advocacy of such methods by Moreau NOV and Shelepin. The specific instructions given by Mironov and Shelepin to the KGB in 1959 to use its expanded intelligence potential among scientists, writers, and other intellectuals for political purposes and to prepare political operations and experiments aimed at dissolving internal opposition in the Soviet Union. The strategic role played by KGB agents of influence among Soviet scientists in the 1960s in promoting the idea of common interests between the Soviet Union and the United States. The debate in the 1960s between liberal and conservative writers inspired and controlled by the KGB through its agents Tvardovsky and Kochetov. The known assets of the KGB among scientists, writers, and other intellectuals in 1960 and the likelihood of their further expansion since then. The prominence of scientists and writers in the dissident movement. If all these factors are kept in mind, there can be no reasonable doubt that the dissident movement as a whole is a KGB-controlled false opposition movement analogous to the Trust, and that many of its leading members are active and willing collaborators with the Central Committee and the KGB. Only if this interpretation is accepted is it possible to explain why a totalitarian, neo-Stalinist regime should allow a degree of Western contact with and freedom of movement to prominent opposition figures. It is, of course, more than likely that some of the individual rank-and-file dissidents are honest people who have become involved in the movement without realizing how they will be exploited and eventually victimized. The movement would not be fulfilling its internal function if it did not succeed in attracting innocence. The main apparent purpose of the movement is to strive for democratization, human rights, and the fulfillment of the Helsinki agreements. The overall impression created in the West is that of a deep-rooted, spontaneous struggle between the regime's conservative supporters and liberal scientists, writers, and other intellectuals. Intense Western indignation, sympathy, and support are naturally aroused by news that dissidents like Sakharov are being harassed, arrested, and sentenced to imprisonment or exile without trial. Emotions are further heightened by the deliberately engineered connection between the problems of Soviet dissidents and those of Soviet Jews. It is perhaps the emotionalism of the West's response that clouds perception of the fact that much of Western knowledge of the dissident movement is acquired by courtesy of the Soviet authorities. The growth of the dissident movement is often seen as one of the fruits of East-West détente in the 1960s. Despite the present apparent persecution of dissidents, long-term Western hopes and expectations of a future liberalization of the Soviet regime have come to be pinned on the eventual success of their heroic struggle. In fact, both the dissident movement and the conspicuous harassment of it by the Soviet authorities are largely artificial, and both form part of the deliberate stage setting for the final phase of long-range bloc policy. This may be expected to begin soon after Brezhnev's disappearance from the political scene, and is likely to include a spurious liberalization of the regime rendered plausible by the rehabilitation of the present dissident leaders. The parallel between the dissident movement and the Trust is not, of course, exact. World conditions changed profoundly in the 50 years between them. In the 1920s, Lenin, Dzerzhinsky, and the GPU were fighting for the survival of communism in one country. In the 1960s and 1970s, dissidents of different kinds came to be exploited throughout the communist bloc, conspicuously in Czechoslovakia in 1968. Dissident movements are discernible elsewhere in Eastern Europe and even in China. The present chapter will be confined to an examination of the unofficial dissident leader, Sakharov, now living in internal exile in the city of Gorky. Sakharov is a scientist of distinction whose past services to the Soviet regime and the development of nuclear weapons are officially recognized. As one of the chief scientific advisors to the Soviet government, he would have had access to the most sensitive nuclear secrets and an insight into Soviet strategy and Soviet relations in the nuclear field with other communist states, including China. It is inconceivable that, if he were seriously at odds with the regime and therefore a security risk, he would have been given the opportunities he has had to maintain contact with Western friends and colleagues. Even from his exile in Gorky, he is able to convey his views to the West through intermediaries and correspondents. The only conclusion consistent with these facts is that Sakharov is still a loyal servant of his regime, whose role is now that of a senior disinformation spokesman for the Soviet strategists. The theme of common interests between East and West, developed by Soviet agents of influence in the 1960s, was expanded after 1968, most notably in Sakharov's writings, into the concept of convergence between the communist and non-communist systems. Before examining Sakharov's statements, brief reference must be made to the change of signpost movements described above. The adherents of this movement asserted that the Soviet regime was evolving from an ideological into a conventional, national, capitalistic state. Therefore, they argued, white Russian émigrés should not struggle against the Soviet regime, but should cooperate with it in order to encourage the development of these trends. The movement had a significant effect both on the émigrés and on the Western governments with which they were in touch, and it created favorable conditions for the regime to win Western diplomatic recognition and economic help. But the adherents of the change of signpost movement were mistaken. Diplomatic recognition and economic help did not result in the evolution of the Soviet Union into a conventional, capitalistic, national state. On the contrary, the Soviet regime emerged from the 1920s stronger, more aggressive, and more ideological than before. The adherents of the change of signpost movement were exposed as bankrupt prophets. Western convergence theorists are unwittingly and naively accepting basically the same disinformation message as the former adherents of the change of signpost movement, namely that the influence of communist ideology is in decline, that communist regimes are coming closer to the Western model, and that there are serious possibilities of further changes in them that will prove favorable to Western interests. In the 1920s, the message was conveyed by the regime through the émigré movement. From 1958 onward, Soviet scientists were used. In the 1920s, the message emphasized the natural tendency of the Soviet regime to move away from ideology toward a capitalist system. In the 1960s, the arguments were rather different. Exponents of convergence argued that, under the influence of the technological revolution, the Soviet Union was developing structural similarities with the West. These structural similarities provided a basis for asserting the existence of common interests between the different systems. Further grounds for asserting the existence of common interests stemmed from the development of nuclear weapons and the necessity of avoiding East-West nuclear conflict. Also, it was argued in the 1960s that the existence of Sino-Soviet differences and Soviet moderation in comparison with Chinese communist militancy created a common interest between the Soviet Union and the West in resisting the yellow peril from the East. Since the notion of genuine evolution in the communist world is unfounded, there are no grounds for asserting that it is converging with the West. And since alleged Sino-Soviet differences are also the product of joint Sino-Soviet disinformation, there is no basis for asserting the existence of common interests between the West and either the Soviet Union or China against the other. The notions of convergence and common interests have both been shaped by communist disinformation in the interests of long-range communist policy. Western convergence theories are themselves built largely on the acceptance at face value of communist disinformation. Western desire for convergence between the communist and non-communist systems is, by and large, sincere. There's genuine, intense, and legitimate concern about the avoidance of an East-West nuclear conflict. There is therefore a Western predisposition to accept the authenticity of Sakharov's dissent as expressed, for example, in his treatise. Allegedly circulated privately in the Soviet Union and published unofficially in the West under the title Progress, Coexistence, and Intellectual Freedom. And in the later book Sakharov speaks, point one, acceptance of spurious notions of convergence has in fact been widespread in the West. Acceptance of the authenticity of fabricated Sino-Soviet disagreements has been almost universal. The false notions inspired by these deceptions aroused expectations among Western policymakers and the general public of a serious improvement in relations between the Soviet Union and the West in the 1960s and China and the West in the 1970s. Whether Western exponents of convergence realized it or not, and most did not, their attitudes were shaped by the bloc and its disinformation effort, whose main objective was to create favorable conditions for the achievement of the strategic objectives of the bloc's long-range policy. The main lines of Sakharov's reasoning on convergence are set out in Convergence of Communism and Capitalism, the Soviet View, and in Sakharov Speaks Point 2 in them. Sakharov is concerned about the annihilation of humanity, and therefore offers a better alternative. Then he divides present and future world developments into several overlapping stages. In the first stage, a growing ideological struggle in the socialist countries between Stalinist and Maoist forces, on the one hand, and the realistic forces of leftist-Leninist communist and leftist Westerners, on the other, will lead to a deep ideological split on an international, national, and intraparty scale. According to Sakharov, In the Soviet Union and other socialist countries, this process will lead first to a multi-party system here and there, and to acute ideological struggle and discussions, and then to the ideological victory of the realists. Affirming the policy of increasing peaceful coexistence, strengthening democracy, and expanding economic reforms, 1960 to 1980. The dates reflect the most optimistic unrolling of events. Sakharov continues, in the second stage, persistent demands for social progress and peaceful coexistence in the United States and other capitalist countries, and pressure exerted by the example of the socialist countries and by internal progressive forces, the working class and the intelligentsia, will lead to the victory of the leftist reformist wing of the bourgeoisie, which will begin to implement a program of rapprochement convergence with socialism, i.e., social progress, peaceful coexistence, and collaboration with socialism on a world scale and changes in the structure of ownership. This phase includes an expanded role for the intelligentsia and an attack on the forces of racism and militarism, 1972-85. In the third stage, the Soviet Union and the United States, having overcome their alienation, solve the problem of saving the poorer half of the world. At the same time, disarmament will proceed, 1972-90. In the fourth stage, the socialist convergence will reduce differences in social structure, promote intellectual freedom, science, and economic progress, and lead to the creation of a world government and the smoothing of national contradictions. 1980-2000. For there can be no criticism of Sakharov for his concern over the possibility of nuclear conflict. What is disturbing is that his reasoning on convergence goes further than the Western theories. He envisages convergence on communist terms at the expense of the West. From his reasoning, it is obvious that he accepts the Sino-Soviet split as genuine in itself and as a genuine catalyst for the realignment of world forces. To understand the true meaning of Sakharov's statements, his role must be examined in the light of Shelepin's report and the long-range policy adopted in 1958-60, the period in which Sakharov began to emerge as a public figure in the Soviet Union. As a leading spokesman of the so-called dissident movement, he has all the appearances of a political provocateur. If he were a genuine dissenter, he would not have had the opportunities he has had to make contact with Western friends and colleagues. Furthermore, as an academician working in the nuclear field, he would have enjoyed access at the policy-making level to debates on nuclear strategy at the time when the new long-range policy and the use of disinformation were being launched. He would have known the true state of Sino-Soviet relations in the nuclear, as in other fields. Given the all-embracing character of the disinformation program, any pronouncement by a Soviet scientist on strategic issues must be regarded as having been made on the regime's instructions. Moreover, Sakharov would have known that liberalization in the Soviet Union would eventually come not in the way he suggests, as a spontaneous development, but in accordance with a blueprint worked out carefully in advance by the regime. If he had been a genuine dissenter, he would have exposed the truth. That he has not done so points to the conclusion that he is acting secretly as a spokesman for the regime chosen for the task because of the natural strength of his appeal to Western scientists and liberals. Sakharov predicts changes in the Soviet Union and other socialist countries. These changes will be revealed in the appearance of a multi-party system here and there, and in ideological discussions between Stalinists and realists or Leninists. In this struggle, Sakharov predicts victory for the realists, the Leninists, who, according to him, will affirm the policy of increasing peaceful coexistence, strengthening democracy, and expanding economic reforms. These future changes in the Soviet system are seen by Sakharov as a continuation of present political developments and economic reforms. Reading Sakharov's predictions as the product of Soviet disinformation, the conclusion can be drawn that some of his pronouncements reflect the possible future course of communist actions and their timing. Further political and economic reforms are therefore to be expected in the bloc, and they will again be used for disinformation purposes. These reforms will display an alleged increase in democracy and other superficial resemblances to Western systems and will be accompanied by further demonstrations of alleged Sino-Soviet conflict. From 1980 onward, an expansion of democracy and the appearance of a so-called multi-party system can be expected in the Soviet Union and elsewhere in the bloc. This would be the logical continuation and culmination of the disinformation of the two previous decades and would represent the implementation inside the bloc of the final phase of the long-range policy. In this phase, some of the current dissidents and liberals, like Sakharov himself in the Soviet Union and Dubček in Czechoslovakia, leaders who are allegedly persecuted by their regimes, can be expected to become the leaders of new democratic parties in their countries. Naturally, they will remain under the secret guidance and control of their communist parties. And their emergence as the leaders of new parties will be regarded in the West as sensational new evidence of a true liberalization of communist regimes and as a new basis for the practical realization of convergence between the two systems, as predicted by Sakharov. Reading Sakharov's writings as disinformation and decoding his messages in that light, it can be predicted that the communist bloc will go further in its exploitation of the fictitious Sino-Soviet split, carrying it forward to a formal, but fictitious, break in diplomatic relations and more impressive hostilities than have so far occurred on the Sino-Soviet borders. This may well generate realignment of international forces that will be detrimental to Western interests and favorable to the long-range policy of the bloc. Sakharov predicts changes in the West, particularly in the United States, under pressure of the socialist states and the internal, progressive forces in the U.S. and other Western countries. The leftist reformist wing of the bourgeoisie will win and will begin to implement a program of rapprochement and convergence with socialism. Social progress and changes in the structure of ownership will be introduced. A leftist reformist element will also start collaboration with socialism on a world scale. Forced changes in the political and military structure will occur. During the second phase, 1972-85, the role of the intelligentsia will be expanded and an attack on the forces of racism and militarism will be made. Again, reading Sakharov's predictions as disinformation, it can be deduced that the bloc and its political and ideological allies plan actions in the future to secure actual changes in the West of a kind that Sakharov describes. The purpose of these actions will be to achieve political systems in the West approaching closer to the communist model. The changes planned for the communist system will be deceptive and fictitious. Those planned for the West will be real and actual. That is the meaning of convergence in communist language. It is noticeable and disturbing that Sakharov, a so-called dissident Soviet intellectual, in his references to U.S. racism and militarism, not only uses the normal language of communist propagandists in referring to the present American system, but identifies himself with the substance of long-range communist projections for the exploitation of these issues and appears to be working for their fulfillment. The most striking point about Sakharov's reasoning is his choice of dates, namely 1960-80, when he predicts the expansion of political democracy and economic reform in the socialist countries, and 1972-85, when he predicts forced changes in the U.S. political and military structure. That is to say, his dates roughly coincide with the dates of the adoption of the new long-range bloc policy in 1958-60, and the date for the inception of its final phase, roughly in 1980. This is no fortuitous coincidence, since Sakharov, the secret spokesman of the communist strategists and the secret advocate of their long-range policy, is seeking to inspire and to promote trends in Western thinking on convergence that will coincide with their designs. Read his disinformation and decoded. His predictions of convergence are predictions of the victory of the long-range policy of the bloc and the surrender of the West with the minimum of resistance. That is the true meaning of his most optimistic unrolling of events. In essence, Sakharov's concept of convergence predicts the very outcome for the West about which the author of this book wishes to convey a warning. Sakharov sees the outcome as optimistic and the result of spontaneous developments like the Sino-Soviet split and political and economic reforms in communist countries. He desires this outcome. The purpose of this book is to explain its dangers for the West because it would not be spontaneous. It would be the result of the implementation of the 1958-60 bloc policy in which calculated use is made of fictitious splits and fraudulent evolution and reform promoted with the witting or unwitting help of Soviet scientists and intellectuals like Sakharov and others. The official communist attitude toward convergence theories is described in Convergence of Communism and Capitalism, the Soviet View. According to this book, the Soviets attack convergence theories as expressed both by Western experts and by Sakharov. The Soviet leaders describe convergence as an insidious form of Western subversion and as a new positive form of anti-communism. The Soviets say that the dissemination of ideas of convergence is elevated by the Western countries to the level of government policy. In the Soviet view, convergence theories have two aims. One is to renovate capitalism. The second is to portray a softening or weakening of communism. In other words, the Soviets see the first aim as to defend capitalism and the second as an effort to subvert communism. The Soviets single out for criticism theories of bridge building and theories of industrial and post-industrial society, and their proponents, Fursky, Aaron, Galbraith, Marcuse, Kahn, Brzezinski, Leonard, Bell, and others. Bell is singled out for his theories on the similarities and the changes in the armed forces of opposing systems under the influence of the scientific technological revolution. The Soviets show concern at the effects of convergence theories on Soviet youth and scientists and other intellectuals. Sakharov is given as an example of someone who has fallen under the spell of Western convergence theories and has later advanced his own theories of rapprochement between the two systems. Another physicist, Kapitsa, is mentioned as someone who subscribed to a number of the views voiced by Sakharov. Sixth, there is a chapter in Convergence of Communism and Capitalism, the Soviet View, with the intriguing title, Moscow's Use of Convergence for Its Own Ends. The authors say that the Soviet leaders find the concept of convergence useful as the point of departure for the rejuvenation of ideological education in the Soviet Union. Party workers concerned with doctrine and ideology are urged to refute the new myths of imperialist propaganda and to raise to higher levels understanding of the richness and eternal validity of Marxism-Leninism. The authors say that convergence theories provide a foil against which to stimulate and add zest to Soviet ideological campaigns. More importantly, they provide a cutting edge to Moscow's contention that the USSR continues under siege by an implacable and dangerous enemy despite the Soviet claims that capitalist encirclement is a thing of the past and that the balance of world forces has irrevocably shifted in favor of the USSR. American propaganda and intelligence agencies and the U.S. Embassy in Moscow have all been attacked by the KGB and the Soviet press for spreading ideas on convergence and for using tourism and scientific and technological exchanges for the purpose of subverting Soviet citizens, especially scientists and young people. This threat to the security of the Soviet system has been exploited to justify the intensification by the regime of its controls over Soviet society. The Soviet attack on convergence has been linked with the attacks on Ukrainian nationalists, Zionists, and religious groups in the Soviet Union and abroad. According to the authors, Soviet analysts distinguish, among the proponents of convergence theories, between enemies who use the concept of convergence for subversive purposes and idealists who include prominent scientists, partisans of peace, and opponents of militarism. The idealists, among whom Professor Galbraith figures prominently, are seen by the Soviets as offering promising targets for Soviet influence. Since the authors of Convergence of Communism and Capitalism, the Soviet view do not take into account either the use made of disinformation in the past or the adoption of the new bloc policy in 1958-60 or the new political and disinformation role assigned to Soviet scientists at that time. Their explanation of the use of convergence theories in current Soviet policy is incomplete. The real meaning of attacks on convergence by the Soviet leaders can be understood more fully in the light of the historical background, the analysis of Sakharov's statements on convergence given above, and the conclusion that he acts as a channel for Soviet disinformation and influence. From the mid-1960s onward, the communist regime stepped up the ideological indoctrination of their own populations in preparation for entry into the final phase of policy in about 1980. There was a renewed campaign of ideological and militaristic indoctrination in the Soviet Union in 1966-67 at the same time as, and similar in content to, the Cultural Revolution in China and the attack on counter-revolution in Czechoslovakia in 1968. While intensifying their own program of indoctrination, the communist leaders sought to protect their populations from the negative influence of Western ideas and the spillover of their own disinformation. In helping to shape Western convergence theories, they had cast a potential boomerang against the West and took steps to prevent it rebounding on their own people. At the same time, it offered them good opportunities to expose and attack the ideological subversion and tricks of Western propaganda. There was nothing new in this technique. It was a typical instance of political provocation. At the same time as the ideas of the Change of Signposts movement were shaped by Soviet disinformation in the 1920s, they were attacked by Soviet propagandists as a Western ideological subversion. The movement was actively exploited for the suppression of internal opposition. The difference between then and now is in the broader scope and greater sophistication of such provocations and the fact that they are practiced by the whole communist bloc. Soviet attacks on convergence, therefore, have, first, a defensive and domestic purpose. Second, they serve the strategic objectives of foreign policy. They help to build up belief in these theories in the West as a sound and effective weapon for dealing with the communist challenge. The communist strategists hope and expect that their criticisms of convergence will be interpreted in the West as evidence of their own concern at the efficacy and impact of such theories on their own regimes and on their scientists in particular. They intend that such criticism should induce Western propagandists to continue and intensify their efforts to advance convergence theories rather than divert their efforts to less irrational and potentially more dangerous themes. Third, Soviet criticism of Sakharov and convergence may be seen as a Soviet effort to build up the credibility in the West of Sakharov and his like as genuine opponents and martyrs of the current Soviet system who are expressing genuine dissent. By disguising convergence as an opposition doctrine, the Soviets can gain greater strategic impact in the West for their concept of convergence, that is to say, to have convergence on their terms. In the light of the 1958-60 bloc policy and the use of disinformation to support it, it can be seen that notions of common interest and convergence have not developed spontaneously in the West, but are the reflections and results of communist disinformation operations whose influence has unwittingly been absorbed by Western exponents of these ideas. Convergence theories are unrealistic because they lack foundations. The impressions that the influence of ideology is declining, that the Soviet Union is evolving from an ideological into a conventional national state, that there is a struggle between the Soviet Union and Communist China, and that the Communist bloc is disintegrating are all false. These impressions are the product of bloc disinformation operations that have successfully hidden the true situation. Since 1958-60, communist ideology in the communist countries has been revived, restored, and intensified. The communist bureaucracy has been given a new, constructive purpose, real and effective, but secret. Coordination between the communist countries, especially between the Soviet Union and China, has been practiced on the basis of the long-range policy. Whether intended to or not, Western convergence theories effectively contribute to the successful fulfillment of this policy. They promote détente, and thereby help the communist bloc to acquire advanced technology from the West and to shift the balance of power in communist favor. They provide an unsound basis for a rational Western response to the increasing communist political and military threat. They promote the political and ideological disarmament of the West. They divert Western diplomatic effort from the reinforcement of Western anti-communist alliances toward illusory and unrealistic realignments with one or another communist state. They create exaggerated expectations in the West about the possibilities of accommodation with the communist world. They are laying a basis for destroying Western morale and public confidence in those Western statesmen, diplomats, and academics who have expounded theories based on common interest and convergence and who will be exposed as bankrupt prophets when the notion of convergence is exploded. Such has been the success of the spurious notion of convergence in the present phase of long-range policy that new Sakharovs and new variations of convergence theory may confidently be expected to appear in the third and final phase. Objectives of disinformation on dissidents. The creation of a false, controlled opposition movement like the dissident movement serves internal and external strategic purposes. Internally, it provides a vehicle for the eventual false liberalization of a communist regime. It provokes some would-be opposition elements to expose themselves to counteraction, and others are driven to conformity or despair. Externally, dissidents can act as vehicles for a variety of disinformation themes on the subject of the evolution of the communist system. A well-advertised wave of persecution of dissidents, partly genuine and partly spurious, generates Western sympathy for, and vulnerable alignments with, those who are secret creatures of the regime. It sets the scene for an eventual dramatic liberalization of the system by heightening the contrast between neo-Stalinism and future socialism with a human face. It creates a cadre of figures who are well known in the West and who can be used in the future as the leaders and supporters of a multi-party system under communism. Dissident trade unions and intellectuals can be used to promote solidarity with their Western counterparts and engage them in joint campaigns for disarmament and the reform of Western military-industrial complexes. In the long run, the Western individuals and groups involved will face the choice of admitting that their support for dissidents was mistaken or accepting that communism has undergone a radical change, making convergence an acceptable, and perhaps desirable, prospect.